Broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain, BC, we are CJSF 90.1 FM, and we are diverse, independent, and yours.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded Wednesday, August 20th, 2025. Well, as fish can't perceive water, we in the West are too blinded to the constant stream of mal and misinformation. Take China, beginning with blue-collar gripes about stolen jobs and the ubiquitous consumer belief everything coming from China is cheap crap. We fail to recognize the patently obvious. It was Western corporations who abandoned the working class here, and they who profit selling us cheap crap made to order. They're the ones, not China, who created the new social reality, a reality of growing poverty and hopelessness. The corporate interests, though, are beginning to fear China has grown beyond them, as its astounding development shatters the comfortable assumption China and Chinese people aren't capable of excellence and innovation independent of Western patronage. That success is forcing a more desperate strategy, an attempt by America and its famous coalition to contain the momentum with war. To accomplish that, they're channeling fear to manufacture hate in the public mind, a preparation for the next great conflagration. Dylan Sullivan is an adjunct fellow and PhD candidate in the Macquarie School of Social Sciences at Macquarie University, where he teaches politics, sociology, and anthropology. He's co-author with Jason Hickel of several articles published at Al Jazeera and other places too, including his most recent, The Real Reason the West is Warmongering Against China. Dylan Sullivan in the first half. And as the 23rd month of Israel's genocide in Gaza approaches, the scale of the rogue state's criminality is difficult to imagine, let alone catalog, but historians will have to wait. The worst is not over as Israel begins to repeat the horrors practiced in Gaza in the West Bank. Dr. Dorothea Gucciardo is the Director of Development for GLIA, Equal Care, and leads GLIA.org's Open Gaza Initiative project. She's a literal eyewitness to the Gaza genocide and member of Eyewitness Gaza, a coalition of health professionals, aid workers, community leaders, and others who are calling out policymakers and the media for their failures to reveal and demand an end to Israel's 21st century Holocaust. Dorothea Gucciardo and Eyes on Palestine's West Bank in the second half. But first, Dylan Sullivan and distilling fear of the dragon once woken. Welcome to the program, Dylan.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Dylan, yours and Jason Hickel's article refers to the core nations of the capitalist world system. Who, Dylan, are and what is that core?
Right. So when we talk about the core of the world system, I suppose we are really talking about the countries of Western Europe and Western Europe's settler colonies, what's often called Western Europe's offshoots, like Australia and the United States, Canada and New Zealand, and then we might add Japan in there as well. So really, these are the countries that are often called the developed countries or the advanced economies or the first world, depending who's speaking. The reason we use the term core, so this concept of a core really comes out of theories of international inequality and development that are developed by academics and scholars and theorists from the global south sort of immediately following European colonialism. And they're trying to theorize where global inequality comes from, what causes it. And this concept of core and periphery. So we use the term core to refer to the developed economies of Western Europe and et cetera, and periphery to refer to the economies of Asia, Latin America, Africa, Eastern Europe. And the reason that scholars from the global south start to use these terms is that it draws our attention to a structural relationship. So understanding international inequality as the result of a relationship of exploitation between the core and the periphery. So the periphery does not suffer underdevelopment and poverty because those are natural conditions. Rather, that is the result of this ongoing process of exploitation that is forced on the periphery by the core economies. There was a just to give you a sense of what I mean by that, there was a study that came out in the journal Global Environmental Change a few years ago that looked into what's called unequal exchange. So unequal exchange refers to a situation where one country, in effect, has to export more labor and resources than it imports. So every year, or in the most recent year of data, in 2015, the peripheral economies, so again, I'm talking about the countries of the global south in Africa, Latin America, Asia, and Eastern Europe, have to export 13 person years of labor for every one person year of labor that they import. We're talking about labor embodied in goods and services. So that means if you sort of aggregate trade with that ratio, that the periphery is annually sending 188 million person years of labor to the core without any labor in return. This is sort of a free gift from the peripheral economies to the core economies. And this happens because of international price differences. Basically, because wages and prices are lower in the periphery than they are in the core, the periphery has to export more labor than it imports just to maintain a monetary balance of trade. And why does this matter? Well, these millions of person years, this huge army of labor that annually works in the global south to produce exports to the core economies without a direct return, these millions of person years, they could, that labor could be allocated towards producing necessary goods and services in the global south, but instead it's being used to produce fast fashion and cheap gadgets and
the cheap crap that I mentioned in the introduction.
The cheap resources that the global north depends on for its wealth, really.
So there's the core and the periphery, but you also write about the semi-periphery. Where does that fit into this equation?
Well, that's a good question. I suppose the concept of the semi-periphery really captures here the fact that the periphery, it's that there's not a neat distinction here. There's something of a spectrum. So some countries in the periphery, say the Democratic Republic of Congo, are more exploited than others, like China, for instance. China has sufficient economic strength, much more economic strength than somewhere like the Democratic Republic of Congo. And so the concept of semi-periphery there would capture that. But to some extent, I think it's useful to think just about core and periphery, because it captures the fact that there is this distinction between some states in the world economy that are net exploited. They export more labor than they import due to international price inequalities. And then there's a very small number of states located exclusively in Western Europe, North America, Australia, Japan, South Korea could be added to this, which are able to import huge amounts of labor, which they don't have to pay anything for. They simply appropriate it for free. And so in some ways, the semi-periphery can confuse what is actually a real distinction between two camps.
Well, and is this distinction or this relationship of exploitation, as you describe it, is that static, or is this subject to change? Like the Premier League has relegation, where some teams might fall below and into a different category. Or is this something that is written in stone for the convenience of economists or any other reason?
Well, that's an interesting question. So the short answer is no, it's not set in stone. There are examples of states moving between these categories, changing their place in this relationship of exploitation. The most obvious one that comes to mind is South Korea, which was a colony of Japan and mercilessly exploited by Japanese imperialists. It was a very low-income country up until very recently. However, the United States, really from sort of the 1980s onwards, maybe 1970s, pursued a policy of intentionally building up South Korea's industrial and economic strength through huge transfers of foreign aid by actually crucially by allowing South Korea to pursue economic policies that other states in the periphery weren't permitted to pursue. And we might get to talking about that in a bit. Basically, South Korea was allowed to protect its infant industries, to use tariffs to protect its industrial base from foreign competition, and to build up its economic strength. And so South Korea has been able to shift positions. There's other examples we can point to. So South Korea's position is the United States does this because it uses South Korea as a kind of military bulwark against the Soviet Union and China, which the United States is keen to sort of keep down. And there's other cases we can talk about like that. Greece probably fits into a similar camp where it was kind of a fairly low-income country, and then the United States kind of pours aid into Greece through the Marshall Plan, basically as a way of building Greece up as kind of a military outpost right on the border of the Eastern Bloc and right in the center of West Asia, in a sense. So there are cases of countries that have switched position. However, they are the exception. I mean, the world system has been incredibly stable in terms of the countries that are in either camp. I mean, I would stress stability far more than change on this question. I mean, in 1945, the economic strength of the United States was so overwhelming. I mean, it controlled the vast majority of the world's productive assets. That has slipped, but it slipped from a very high mark, and the West continues to dominate the world system. But China is challenging it. I mean, this is what we wrote about in the recent Al Jazeera article. China has been making some substantial gains in the recent decade, and this, of course, has not been welcomed by Washington.
Yeah, let's talk about that. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dylan Sullivan. Dylan's a researcher in the School of Social Science in Macquarie University, Sydney, Australia, and in the Institute of Environmental Science and Technology at the Autonomous University of Barcelona, or Barcelona. His research focuses on global inequality and poverty. He has published several papers, including Capitalism and Extreme Poverty, a Global Analysis of Real Wages, Human Height, and Mortality since the long 16th century, in the Journal of World Development and Capitalist Reforms and Extreme Poverty in China, Unprecedented Progress or Income Deflation, in the New Political Economy magazine. He also writes for The Conversation, New Internationalists, and Al Jazeera, as I mentioned off the top. And we are talking in and around his article, The Real Reason, the West is Warmongering Against China, co-authored with Jason Hickel. Now, I said in the introduction quite dramatically, I think, or I tried to at least, that the America is intent on creating a war with China for the very reason that it can't compete with it economically, and that it is declining precipitously as China rises phoenix-like, or as I said, the dragon has been awoken. So now disabuse me of this idea. Am I way off mark here in saying in the scenario that I just described?
That China is dramatic. Well, I think that there's room for overstating this case. I mean, I've thrown a lot of data at you, but I want to keep putting the point. If you look at the lowest decile of income earners in the United States, so that's the poorest 10% of people in the United States, their consumption is equivalent to $23 per day in 2021 prices. Now, in China, if you look at the income of the poorest decile, it's $5 or just under $6. So there is a substantial gap between the United States and China here. And China continues to export large quantities of labor and resources to the United States without a direct return, because the United States benefits from cheap labor and resources that it extracts from China. However, there is a really important point you're making here, which China is pushing against the boundaries of its peripheral subordination within the world system. Since about, I think really we've seen a big shift since about 2015 in terms of, or since sort of the 2010s in sort of China's position. You can see this, for instance, in wages. So around 2010, there was a massive wave of labor strikes across China. Workers went on strike, pushed for higher wages. Since then, wages have increased enormously. So in about 2005, the average wage in China was $1, which was about the same as India. By today, the average wage, that's the average hourly wage in China was about $1, which was about the same as India. If you look at it today, the average wage in China is $8, which is still lower than the United States, but it's much higher than India, which now is $2. Now, this increase in wages has really pushed back against China's peripheral position in the world system. It has put a constraint on the ability of the United States and the global north to extract cheap labor from China. At the same time as wages have been growing like this, equally important, China has really started to use sort of state-led industrial policy, public finance, tariffs and protections to finance technological developments and to push back on Western monopolies. So I spoke a little bit earlier about this system of unequal exchange, where the core economies are able to appropriate labor through trade. They're able to do this in large part because they monopolize certain technological sectors, and that allows them to charge. So we're talking about things here like aerospace engineering, high-tech information technology. I used to give this figure, it's data from 2008, so it's a bit old now, that the global north controls 97% of all patents. So if you think of all intellectual property rights globally, the global north controls about 97% of those. That allows the global north to charge really high markups on its exports and to force down the price of commodities that it's importing from the global south. China is really putting that system under strain now. Before doing this interview, had a quick look at the data on patent requests for this year, so the application of new patents. And China accounts now for 30%, I believe it is, of new patents that have been requested over the last year. So this is a major change to a system where the global north was controlling 97% of patents. And now when you look at new patents coming through, China is accounting for a fair chunk of them. Now, again, I come back to my point. I'm very wary of taking this rise of China narrative too far. I think we need to keep in mind that China continues to be a middle-income country with about the same income as Mexico. I mean, the richest 10% in China have $27 per day in US prices, adjusted for differences in purchasing power. If they lived in the United States, that would put them in the lowest bottom, the second lowest bottom decile. So that is the 10% of richest people in China would be in the 20% of poorest people if they lived in the United States. That's according to World Bank consumption data. So I don't want to take this rise of China narrative too far. China continues to be an exploited peripheral economy. However, it is challenging that system. China is beginning to challenge that system of exploitation. And this is a good thing, I think. This is good news, not only for China, not only for Chinese workers, but for the world. It's a good thing if countries in the global south can push against this system of imperialist domination that has characterized the world economy for centuries. But even these very modest, very cautious steps towards national sovereignty have not been acceptable to the United States and Western Europe. And so we have seen the core economies respond to China's sort of fairly modest rises in its national, in its capacity for independent development. They've responded to this with a massive military buildup on China's border, with military bases in South Korea, in Japan, all through the Pacific. And they've responded with economic sanctions. I think that the tariffs Donald Trump has just put against China need to be seen in this in this light, that it is a response to China's challenging of its peripheral status in the world system, which the United States can't accept, or that the United States ruling class cannot accept. And it's interesting. So what I'm saying here basically is that the problem for the United States is that China's export prices are becoming too high. China is no longer willing to play the game of being a cheap export economy for Western multinationals. Now, this explanation, of course, is in marked contrast to the explanation that you often hear. So Donald Trump has tried to claim that his objections to China's economic strategy is that China's prices are too low. And as you know, as your listeners will be aware, Donald Trump and many other Western pundits have often tried to claim that China that China cheats in international trade by lowering the exchange rate of its currency artificially and thereby driving its export prices down. There's a problem with this explanation, though, which is that China stopped pursuing its deflationary currency policy around 2014 or 2015. And in fact, by the mid-2010s, China was in fact doing the opposite. It was spending quite a large amount of its foreign currency reserves attempting to keep its exchange rate high, trying to resist market pressures to depreciate its exchange rate. And in fact, the effect that Trump's tariffs have had has been to force the Chinese government to depreciate the currency, not because it's keeping the Chinese currency below the market exchange rate, but because it is responding to market pressures. The tariffs have reduced the demand for Chinese goods, and as any economist would tell you, that's going to cause a depreciation in the exchange rate. So two things to note there. First, China stopped pursuing its policy of reducing, of artificially suppressing its currency about 10 years ago. Second, the effect of the tariffs, and in my view, probably the intended effect of the tariffs, has been to weaken the Chinese currency and therefore force Chinese export prices back down. Actually, it's interesting that the shift in Chinese policy towards raising its exchange rate around 2014 or 2015 exactly coincides with the shift in US policy from cooperation with China to military buildup against China, to economic sanctions, to tariffs, and to trade wars. In fact, the US supported China while it was suppressing its exchange rate and while it was keeping its wages and prices low, and has now turned decisively against China at the very moment that China has started to raise its prices.
You say, you write, you and Jason, that China's spectacular economic development has brought up the price of its labor and dwindled Western corporate profits. And you also say that one of the main pillars of the imperial arrangement is monopoly over necessary technologies like capital goods, medicines, computers, aircraft, and so on. In that regard, as the Trump sanctions have gone and carried on from the preceding administration, the Biden administration as well, China has filled the gap with innovation. We've seen this in the computer field. We've seen it in medicine. We've seen it in transportation. We've seen it in a lot of areas where China has decided that this sanction pushed by the Americans has accelerated, not decelerated, China's development, it would seem to me.
Yeah, I think that that's true. I mean, I think it's a little bit too early to tell, but I am also hopeful that China is going to be able to that's exactly what's going to happen, that China is going to continue along the path of technological development and sovereign economic development, and that's certainly a possibility. At the same time, I wouldn't underestimate the continuing economic strength of the United States and the Western core economies. I mean, the fact that China's economy does continue to be dependent to a large extent on demand from the United States is a concern. And hopefully the tariffs will accelerate China's desire to not be dependent, to reduce its dependence on the US market. But well, that's we will see.
Well, Dylan, we're fast running out of time. But I would say my concern is the opposite of that, that America is lost in a quagmire, a downward spiral economically. You also write, though, that China may have the power to prevent the U.S. from imposing its will on it, but it does not have the power to impose its will on the rest of the world in the way that the core states, which I would say just means America, do. Does China have the ability to defend itself against a determined American military engagement or assault or attempt to destroy its economy?
Well, yes. I mean, it depends what we mean by defend itself. I mean, I think we need to keep in our mind that a war, an actual military conflict, a major military conflict between the United States and China would not be good for anyone. I mean, these are both nuclear-armed states. I think any sane and rational person should consider it out of the question that these two states would actually go to war with one another in an unrestrained way. I think the consequences for the human race would be unfathomable. And in that sense, there is no defense to be had. I mean, there's no way of defending oneself in a war between two nuclear powers. With that said, I think China does have a deterrent capability, clearly. I mean, the very fact that the war would be so destructive for both sides acts as a clear deterrent to US hostility. I mean, in terms of the broader point here, what I really do want to stress, though, is the point which you just mentioned of China is not in a position and frankly doesn't actually show an intention to impose its will on the rest of the world in the way that the United States has been doing for decades. It's really important to keep in mind the huge military asymmetry between the United States and China. So the US-led military bloc, that is the US, NATO, South Korea, Israel, they account for 75% of total global military spending. The United States alone accounts for 54%. China accounts for 10% of global military spending. In per capita terms, US military spending is 21 times higher than Chinese military spending. In terms of nuclear weapons, I mean, just having one nuclear weapon is a huge thing. But in terms of nuclear weapons, the US has nine nuclear weapons for every one nuclear weapon that China has. So the US has over 5,000 nuclear weapons. China has 600. In fact, China's nuclear weapons stockpile is roughly similar to France, the UK and Israel together. It's not on a par with the United States. In terms of military bases, the US has, it depends on the source, but probably around 800 or so military bases outside of its territory, all around the world, many of them on China's border. China, on the other hand, has only one military base outside of its territory, in Djibouti. In fact, a country like Australia, I mean, your listeners could tell from my accent that I'm from Australia. A country like Australia with 25 million people has two military bases outside of its territory, one in Dubai, one in Malaysia. China with more than a billion people, only has one military base. I mean, for perspective here, the UK has probably about 150 or so military bases outside of its territory.
Well, that takes up a lot of that military spending you talked about, for sure. And when they're spending so much on the military, maintaining bases, and America has more than 800 around the world, depending on how you define the bases, I think a lot of that money is spent that way. But sadly, we're out of time. Again, the article is Real Reason the West is warmongering against China. China's spectacular economic development has brought up the price of its labor and dwindled Western corporate profits. That is available at Al Jazeera. It's Jason Hickel and Dylan Sullivan, the authors. Do check that out. Thanks a lot, Dylan, for coming on and talking a little bit about it with us today, eh?
Thanks, Chris. Really appreciate it.
I want everyone to stick around after the break. I'll be back with Dorothea Gucciardo. We're going to talk about the West Bank and Israel's reprise performance of its Gaza Holocaust there. Well, I got to think that we're not alone.
I'm sitting in my house watching all this happen, and I've arrived to a point where I just can't keep my mouth shut anymore.
Guerrilla Radio, you're not alone.
Gaza district becomes one big apocalypse as hunger eats at everyone inside the walled-in ghetto. They all live in where hundreds of thousands have already died. In the final days of the final solution, whatever else somebody claims, there's the Gaza Humanitarian